I shall speak about the study of psychology, but I must warn you that the psychology about which I speak is very different from anything you may know under this name. To begin with, I must say that practically never in history has psychology stood at so low a level as at the present time. It has lost all touch with its origin and its meaning, so that now it is even difficult to define the term psychology, that is, to say what psychology is and what it studies. And this is so in spite of the fact that never in history have there been so many psychological theories and so many psychological writings. Psychology is sometimes called a new science. This is quite wrong. Psychology is perhaps the oldest science, and unfortunately, in its most essential features, a forgotten science. In order to understand how psychology can be defined, it is necessary to realize that psychology, except in modern times, has never existed under its own name. By one reason or another, psychology always was suspected of wrong or subversive tendencies, either religious or political or moral, and had to use different disguises. For thousands of years, psychology existed under the name of philosophy. In India, all forms of yoga, which are essentially psychology, are described as one of the six systems of philosophy. Sufi teachings, which again are chiefly psychological, are regarded as partly religious and partly metaphysical. In Europe, even quite recently, in the last decades of the 19th century, many works on psychology were referred to as philosophy. And in spite of the fact that almost all subdivisions of philosophy, such as logic, the theory of cognition, ethics, aesthetics, referred to the work of the human mind or senses, psychology was regarded as inferior to philosophy, and as relating only to the lower or more trivial sides of human nature. Parallel with its existence under the name of philosophy, psychology existed even longer connected with one or another religion. This does not mean that religion and psychology were ever one and the same thing, or that the fact of the connection between religion and psychology was recognized. But there is no doubt that almost every known religion, certainly I do not mean modern sham religions, developed one or another kind of psychological teaching connected often with a certain practice, so that the study of religion very often included in itself the study of psychology. There are many excellent works on psychology in quite orthodox religious literature of different countries and epochs. For instance, in early Christianity, there was a collection of books of different authors under the general name of Philokalia, used in our time in the Eastern Church, especially for the instruction of monks. During the time when psychology was connected with philosophy and religion, it also existed in the form of art. Poetry, drama, sculpture, dancing, even architecture, were means for transmitting psychological knowledge. For instance, the Gothic cathedrals were in their chief meaning works on psychology. In the ancient times, before philosophy, religion, and art had taken their separate forms as we now know them, psychology had existed in the form of mysteries, such as those of Egypt and of ancient Greece. Later, after the disappearance of the mysteries, psychology existed in the form of symbolical teachings, which were sometimes connected with the religion of the period and sometimes not connected, such as astrology, alchemy, magic, and the more modern masonry, occultism, and theosophy. And here it is necessary to note that all psychological systems and doctrines, those that exist or existed openly, and those that were hidden or disguised, can be divided into two chief categories. First, systems which study man as they find him, or such as they suppose or imagine him to be. Modern scientific psychology, or what is known under that name, belongs to this category. Second, systems which study man not from the point of view of what he is, or what he seems to be, but from the point of view of what he may become, that is, from the point of view of his possible evolution. These last systems are in reality the original ones, or in any case the oldest, and only they can explain the forgotten origin and meaning of psychology. When we understand the importance of the study of man from the point of view of his possible evolution, we shall understand that the first answer to the question, "What is psychology?" should be that psychology is the study of the principle, laws, and facts of man's possible evolution. Here in these lectures I shall speak only from this point of view. Our first question will be, "What does evolution of man mean?" And the second, "Are there any special conditions necessary for it?" As regards ordinary modern views on the origin of man and his previous evolution, I must say at once that they cannot be accepted. We must realize that we know nothing about the origin of man, and we have no proofs of man's physical or mental evolution. On the contrary, if we take historical mankind, that is, humanity for 10 or 15,000 years, we may find unmistakable signs of a higher type of man, whose presence can be established on the evidence of ancient monuments and memorials which cannot be repeated or imitated by the present humanity. As regards prehistoric man or creatures similar in appearance to man, and yet at the same time very different from him, whose bones are sometimes found in deposits of glacial or pre-glacial periods, we may accept the quite possible view that these bones belong to some being quite different from man, which died out long ago. Denying previous evolution of man, we must deny any possibility of future mechanical evolution of man, that is, evolution happening by itself according to laws of heredity and selection, and without man's conscious efforts and understanding of his possible evolution. Our fundamental idea shall be that man as we know him is not a completed being, that nature develops him only up to a certain point, and then leaves him to develop further by his own efforts and devices, or to live and die such as he was born, or to degenerate and lose capacity for development. Evolution of man in this case will mean the development of certain inner qualities and features which usually remain undeveloped and cannot develop by themselves. Experience and observation show that this development is possible only in certain definite conditions, with efforts of a certain kind on the part of man himself, and with sufficient help from those who began similar work before and have already attained a certain degree of development, or at least a certain knowledge of methods. We must start with the idea that without efforts, evolution is impossible. Without help, it is also impossible. After this, we must understand that in the way of development, man must become a different being, and we must learn and understand in what sense and in which direction man must become a different being, that is, what a different being means. Then we must understand that all men cannot develop and become different beings. Evolution is the question of personal efforts, and in relation to the mass of humanity, evolution is the rare exception. It may sound strange, but we must realize that it is not only rare, but is becoming more and more rare. Many questions naturally arise from the preceding statements. What does it mean that in the way of evolution, man must become a different being? What does different being mean? Which inner qualities or features can be developed in man, and how can this be done? Why cannot all men develop and become different beings? Why such an injustice? I shall try to answer these questions, and I shall begin with the last one. Why cannot all men develop and become different beings? The answer is very simple, because they do not want it. because they do not know about it and will not understand without a long preparation what it means, even if they are told. The chief idea is that in order to become a different being, man must want it very much, and for a very long time. A passing desire or a vague desire based on dissatisfaction with external conditions will not create a sufficient impulse. The evolution of man depends on his understanding of what he may get and what he must give for it. If man does not want it, or if he does not want it strongly enough and does not make necessary efforts, he will never develop. So there is no injustice in this. Why should man have what he does not want? If man were forced to become a different being, when he is satisfied with what he is, then this would be injustice. Now we must ask ourselves what a different being means. If we consider all the material we can find that refers to this question, we find an assertion that in becoming a different being, man acquires many new qualities and powers which he does not possess now. This is a common assertion which we find in all kinds of systems admitting the idea of psychological or inner growth of man. But this is not sufficient. Even the most detailed description of these new powers will not help us in any way to understand how they appear and where they come from. There is a missing link in ordinary known theories, even in those I already mentioned which are based on the idea of the possibility of evolution of man. The truth lies in the fact that before acquiring any new faculties or powers which man does not know and does not now possess, he must acquire faculties and powers he also does not possess, but which he ascribes to himself. That is, he thinks he knows them and can use and control them. This is the missing link, and this is the most important point. By way of evolution, as described before, that is, a way based on effort and help, man must acquire qualities which he thinks he already possesses, but about which he deceives himself. In order to understand this better, and to know what are these faculties and powers which man can acquire, both quite new and unexpected, and also those which he imagines that he already possesses, we must begin with man's general knowledge about himself. And here we come at once to a very important fact. Man does not know himself. He does not know his own limitations and his own possibilities. He does not even know to how great an extent he does not know himself. Man has invented many machines, and he knows that a complicated machine needs sometimes years of careful study before one can use it or control it. But he does not apply this knowledge to himself, although he himself is a much more complicated machine than any machine he has invented. He has all sorts of wrong ideas about himself. First of all, he does not realize that he actually is a machine. What does it mean that man is a machine? It means that he has no independent movements, inside or outside of himself. He is a machine which is brought into motion by external influences and external impacts. All his movements, actions, words, ideas, emotions, moods, and thoughts are produced by external influences. By himself, he is just an automaton with a certain store of memories of previous experiences and a certain amount of reserve energy. We must understand that man can do nothing. But he does not realize this and ascribes to himself the capacity to do. This is the first wrong thing that man ascribes to himself. That must be understood very clearly. Man cannot do. Everything that man thinks he does really happens. It happens exactly as it rains or it thaws. In the English language, there are no impersonal verbal forms which can be used in relation to human actions. So we must continue to say that man thinks, reads, writes, loves, hates, starts wars, fights, and so on. Actually, all this happens.